Let's kick off another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word by opening to the book of Nahum. Now, if you need to use your table of contents, that's not a problem. That's what it's there for. It's not a very big book. It won't take us very long to get through it. And it is a book that predicts the destruction of Nineveh. Now, when Nahum wrote, we're pretty sure it was in the middle of the 7th century BC. That's in the 600s BC, during the reign of King Manasseh, the longest reigning king of southern Judah. More than 100 years earlier, we had the ministry of Jonah the prophet, where he went to the city of Nineveh and predicted to them that they were facing God's judgment. But because they repented, they were given more time. Well, that time will run out around 612 BC. And we need to see the prophecies made about that impending destruction. So the book of Nahum begins with this kind of title portion. An oracle concerning Nineveh, the book of the vision of Nahum of Elkosh. Now, Nahum, his name means something like consolation or comfort. And he is from a town that is not mentioned anywhere else in Scripture or even in the historical writings of the Jews, I believe. Elkosh may, in fact, be a city in Assyria itself. There is a town that has a very similar name, about one day's walk north of Nineveh itself. Now, you might want to ask the question at this point, well, why would a prophet of Israel be living up in the area near Nineveh? Well, the answer is that we've already entered the time of the Assyrian exile. All of northern Israel is gone. It's finished. The people that did not die had been deported or relocated into Assyria. So there most definitely were Israelis living probably all around Nineveh. And so Nahum may be one such prophet that Lord decides to use. His family may have been transported up here. The tradition is that he was born, lived, prophesied, died, and was buried at this town a little ways north of Nineveh. And so we're going to kind of go with that idea. And I believe he mentions some things down in the Promised Land. He might have traveled down there temporarily before returning back to Assyria proper. And so this is the message that he proclaims. Nahum chapter 1, verse 2. He who is a jealous and avenging God. He who is avenging and wrathful. He who is takes vengeance on his adversaries and keeps wrath for his enemies. And then we have a little bit of an allusion back to what Moses knew about God, what God had told Moses about himself. Verse 3, he who is slow to anger and great in power. And he who is will by no means clear the guilty. So God has already testified that he is gracious, he is loving, he is compassionate, he wants to forgive. But for those that do not repent, he will bring judgment. He will bring justice, and it will be rough because not being in the presence of God, not having an eternal relationship with God, is going to be rough. Verse 3 continues, "His way is in whirlwind and storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet." And so you kind of think about a tornado or a really bad thunderstorm and how that can be scary. Well, coming under God's judgment is similar to that. Verse 4, "He rebukes the sea and makes it dry. He dries up all the rivers." So God, when he wishes to do so, can stop the sea from going here, there, or make the sea go here or there. He can dry up the waters of the sea and let his people pass over, or one of his prophets. Verse 4 continues, "Bashan and Carmel wither. The bloom of Lebanon withers." When God brings judgment in the sense or in the form of a drought, even the green places like Bashan, where that was cattle country, it's on the east side of the Jordan Valley, or Carmel, the great big 25-mile-long ridge that divides Galilee area and the valley of Jezreel and the plain of Megiddo from the hill country down in Samaria, and also from the coastal plain down toward Judah. Very green, very lush, but when a drought comes, it dries up. And the bloom of Lebanon, the Lebanon mountains to the north of Israel, lots of vegetation. But if a drought comes along, it can turn brown. And so the mountains quake before him, the hills melt, the earth heaves before him, and the world and all who dwell in it. Who can stand before his indignation? Who can endure the heat of his anger? His wrath is poured out like fire, and the rocks are broken into pieces by him. Some of that might be imagery from what happened at Mount Sinai when God appeared to Israel in the ancient times, at the very beginning of their existence as a nation. And the whole place was shaking violently underneath his presence. Verse 7, "He who is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble. He knows those who take refuge in him." So a little reminder here that this is not about what's going to happen to the righteous. This is about what God does to the unrighteous. Verse 8, "But with an overflowing flood, he will make a complete end of his adversaries and will pursue his enemies into darkness. What do you plot against he who is?" That's a rhetorical question. You can't. You cannot have a successful plot against God. "He will make a complete end. Trouble will not rise up a second time. For they are like entangled thorns, like drunkards as they drink. They are consumed like stubble, fully dried." So thorns, stubble, they get burned up. Drunkards can, when they're stumbling around, fall into a fire and be burned. Verse 11, "For you came one who plotted evil against he who is a worthless counselor." So this is a reference to Assyria. The Assyrian Empire had gotten it into its head that it was going to overtake the entire Middle East. And they had successfully taken most of the Middle East, but they didn't get Judah because God was standing up for Judah, and Hezekiah was his righteous servant at that time. But they tried, and God reminds them through this prophet, "You tried to plot against me and my people, and I have not forgotten that." Verse 12, "Thus says he who is, though they are at full strength and many, they will be cut down and pass away. Though I have afflicted you, I will afflict you no more, And now I will break his yoke from off you and will burst your bonds apart. Now that part is a reference to the Israeli people, a reminder that when he brings judgment against the Assyrians, that will be good for his people. Verse 14. He who is has given commandment about you. No more shall your name be perpetuated. No more shall your name be perpetuated, for in the house of your gods I will cut off the carved image and the metal image. I will make your grave, for you are vile. So the Assyrian Empire is going to suddenly collapse. And God is going to be the one causing this. And it'll be an end to a lot of their idolatry. Verse 15. Behold, upon the mountains, the feet of him who brings good news, who publishes peace. Now, if that sounds familiar, that's because that is also in the book of Isaiah, chapter 52, verse 7. And that's because Isaiah was a great prophet shortly before the time of Nahum. And so he would have been familiar with the wording of Isaiah's prophecies. Keep your feasts, O Judah. Fulfill your vows, for never again shall the worthless pass through you. He is utterly cut off. Now, even in the midst of this warning against the Assyrians, there's little hints that when God says, no more will you be hassled, that is kind of thinking way in the future too. That when God cuts off the last enemy, which is Satan and death, there will be no more problems. But the Assyrian Empire itself is about to collapse, and so Judah will never have to worry about them again. Now, the successors of the Assyrian Empire would be the Babylonians, and they are the ones that Judah will have to deal with in a negative way. Chapter 2. The scatterer has come against you. Man the ramparts. Watch the road. Dress for battle. Collect all your strength. So when the Assyrians have the tables turned on them and they end up being attacked instead of being the attackers, they'll understand that it's coming from the Lord. For he who is restoring the majesty of Jacob as the majesty of Israel. For plunderers have plundered them and ruined their branches. The shields of his mighty men is red. His soldiers are clothed in scarlet. The chariots come with flashing metal. On the day he musters them, the cypress spears are brandished. The chariots race madly through the streets. They flash or rush to and fro through the squares. They gleam like torches. They dart like lightning. So this is a picture of the invasion and the overtaking of the Assyrian empire. And the Babylonians are going to have an awful lot to do with that. The Egyptians will be in the mix, but mostly Babylonians are the ones we're thinking about. He remembers his officers. They stumble as they go. They hasten to the wall. The siege tower is set up. The river gates are open. The palaces melt. The palace melts away. Now, Nineveh sits right on the Tigris River. And so they have river gates. And so these are going to be opened up. And people will be able to come in through them. And the palaces will be, the palace particularly, will be plundered. Its mistress is stripped, she is carried off, her slave girls lamenting, moaning like doves, and beating their breasts. Now, I guess I should give my customary warning at this point. As we start describing all of the judgments coming against Nineveh, we're actually describing the overrunning of a city by marauding opposing military forces. And unfortunately, that often brings some really rough treatment of people. And so I want you, if you've got younger listeners that you don't want to have to talk to about the vagaries of war, the realities of warfare, you might want to get them busy somewhere else, okay? So here we have this warning that when the marauding forces come in, you've got the slave girls crying over the fact that their mistress, and I think this is probably symbolic of Nineveh itself, is being ripped apart, stripped of all its things. And so they are crying. They sound like doves, and they're beating their breasts in the Middle Eastern way of showing sorrow. Nineveh is like a pool whose waters run away. Again, they're right next to a river. So water that drains away is kind of how Nineveh is going to be depopulated. Halt, halt, they cry, but none turns back. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold. There is no end of the treasure or of the wealth of all precious things. If you can imagine during all their time as an empire, how much accumulated wealth they've brought in from other nations and kind of stored up here at Nineveh, all that's going to be taken away. Desolate, desolation and ruin. Hearts melt and knees tremble. Anguish is in all loins. All faces grow pale. So everybody's scared and they lose their courage and they're just physically collapsing. Where is the lion's den, the feeding place of the young lions, where the lion and lioness went, where his cubs were with none to disturb? The lion tore enough for her cubs and strangled prey for his lioness. He filled his caves with prey and his dens with torn flesh. More than once, we've seen nations described as animals. And in this case, Assyria, Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, is described as this lion that's been ripping into all the other nations around and taking home, meat, or wealth back to Nineveh to be shared amongst all the other Ninevites. And all that's going to come to an end. Behold, I am against you, declares he who is over the armies. I will burn your chariots in smoke, and the sword shall devour your young lions. So chariots are going to be gone. They're going to be destroyed in the fights. And the young lions here, probably talking about the charioteers and the fighting members of the military. They're the young lions that are going to be chewed up by God. I will cut off your prey from the earth, and the voice of your messenger shall no longer be heard. So Nineveh will come to an end. We know the date is about 612 BC, and this is being written probably somewhere around the 650s or so, I'm guessing. Chapter 3. Woe to the bloody city, all full of lies and plunder. No end to the prey. So again, they've collected all sorts of stuff. The crack of the whip, the rumble of the wheel, galloping horse and bounding chariot, horsemen charging, flashing sword and glittering spear. So we've got all this picture of Nineveh being overrun by military forces. Let's just think of them as the Babylonian forces. And so you've got the sound of the whipping to get the horses to run faster and the rumbling of the wheels as they come charging through the streets, and the horsemen are gathering around with their swords and their spears, and they're taking people out right and left. Listen to this next part. Hosts of slain, heaps of corpses, dead bodies without end. They stumble over the bodies. So there's so many dead bodies, people are falling over them. And all for the countless whorings of the prostitute, graceful and of deadly charms, who betrays nations with her whorings and people with her charms. And so Nineveh is seen as this prostitute as well, that's been tricking people with her cons. Behold, I am against you, declares he who is of the hosts or over the armies. I will lift up your skirts over your face, and I will make nations look at your nakedness and kingdoms at your shame. So one of the things that unfortunately happened is that sometimes the women, even the top-level women, were raped during the warfare, especially in a city that had been carrying out atrocities against other countries and other cities. And so it's pictured here that basically Nineveh is going to suffer what she has been doing to everyone else. I will throw filth at you and treat you with contempt and make you a spectacle. So she's going to be dragged through the dirt, through the junk, because of what she's done. And all who look at you will shrink from you and say, wasted is Nineveh. Who will grieve for her? Where shall I seek comforters for you? So nobody's going to be sorry, except fellow Ninevites, because the Assyrians, I've told you before, were very much the Nazis of their time period. They treated everyone else as animals and just resources to be exploited. Verse 8. Are you better than Thebes that sat by the Nile with water around her, her rampart a sea, and water her wall? Cush was her strength, Egypt too, and that without limit. Put and the Libyans were her helpers. So Thebes was a very famous city in Egypt, a powerhouse back in time, several centuries earlier. But the Assyrians came in and took it back in 663 BC, which is one of the reasons we know this book is written after that year. So the question is asked, you think you're better than Thebes that you trashed? No, you're not. Verse 10, yet she became an exile. She went into captivity. Her infants were dashed in pieces at the head of every street. For her honored men, lots were cast, and all her great men were bound in chains. That's the stuff the Assyrians did to the people of Thebes. Well, you also will be drunken. You will go into hiding. You will seek a refuge from the enemy. And all your fortresses are like fig trees with first ripe figs. If shaken, they fall into the mouth of the eater. So the imagery is, you guys are just like a ripe, an overripe fig tree waiting to be plucked because of the judgment that needs to come. Behold, your troops are women in your midst. The gates of your land are wide open to your enemies. Fire has devoured your bars. Draw water for the siege. Strengthen your forts. Go into the clay. Tread the mortar. Take hold of the brick mold. There will be fire to devour you. The sword will cut you off. It'll devour you like the locust. Multiply yourselves like the locust. Multiply like the grasshopper. You increased your merchants more than the stars of heavens. The locust spreads its wings and flies away. So it doesn't matter that they built their city up thinking that it was going to be strong with all this, these baked bricks. Doesn't matter that they were multiplying how many people were living in here. They are done. Verse 17, your princes are like grasshoppers. Your scribes like clouds of locusts settling on the fences in a day of cold. When the sun rises, they fly away. No one knows where they are. So again, the picture here is that Assyria, through its years as the empire, it's been building itself up. It's been multiplying itself. But when its judgment comes, bad things are going to happen. And those that can are going to try to fly away like grasshoppers trying to scatter away from the cold that's kind of slowed them down. Verse 18, your shepherds are asleep, O king of Assyria. Your nobles slumber. Your people are scattered on the mountains with none to gather them. So this is the prediction of what it's going to be like when 612 BC comes around. The shepherds, the leaders, will be totally worthless. They'll be sleeping in the sense that they won't be aware of how bad the situation is until it's over with. And the end of the Assyrian Empire comes with a very quick uptick of them losing battles. So then they will be scattered. The people will be scattered. Verse 19, there is no easing your hurt. Your wound is grievous. So everything they'd been spared of in the days of Jonah, because they repented. Fast forward to 612, they will receive it many times over until Nineveh is a ruinous heap. And the people are scattered. All who hear the news about you clap their hands over you, for upon whom has not come your unceasing evil. So everybody in the Middle East will pretty much be happy and applauding, clapping the destruction of the city of Nineveh because they had done so much damage for several generations to all the other peoples of the Middle East. And thus ends the prophecy of Nahum and the prediction that Nineveh does not have much time left. Well, tomorrow we'll come back to 2 Chronicles 33, and we will pick up the story of Manasseh, the longest reigning king of southern Judah, and their worst king, who thankfully repented.